Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. Ernest, we're coming up to the end of the year.
Yep.
Just like that, 2025 is coming to an end. It's getting chilly outside. People are putting up the Christmas trees, getting ready to light the Hanukkah lights, and getting ready to take some time off as we head into the end of the year. It hasn't been the most incredible year, but it's certainly been a very newsworthy year. And, you know, if you want to check out all the topics that we talked about on our podcast in 2025, tariffs and AI and compounding, we have tons and tons of videos for you. And we really appreciate you checking out our podcast. Thank you for joining us. Our podcast numbers are growing, so thank you so much. Today, we're going to get into our feature discussion is going to be about oil and gas and why we're sticking with Tourmaline and Canadian Natural Resources, CNQ, both large Canadian oil and gas companies. Haven't done a whole lot of anything this year, but we're going to tell you why we're sticking with our thesis on those companies. As well, we're going to get into some earnings reviews of Garmin, of TransDigm, and Brookfield. Everybody likes to talk about Brookfield. Long-term investment in our portfolio. But before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, of course, please subscribe to us on Apple, on YouTube, and on Spotify. We appreciate your five-star reviews. We appreciate your feedback. Please, of course, if you have any interest in Baskin Wealth Management, please check out our website. We'd love to talk to you about your portfolio. And that's all we got. In the meantime, Ernest, the stock market, after a terrific couple years in a row for our clients, it's kind of been a mediocre 2025. Hopefully, maybe tomorrow or December will bring better markets. But the one thing that I'm happy about is the stock market's going to decide what it wants to do in the short term. But one thing that we can control is investing in companies that are producing strong results. And as we've gone through most of the Q3 earnings, hearing from our companies about their expectations as they're guiding for Q4 as well as 2026, we feel really, really good about our portfolio. We're working on a special presentation that we hope to deliver to everybody in the next month or so. We're going to talk about our investment style and things we like. We'll call it, I guess, like an outlook presentation for 2026. Ernest, myself, and Benjamin Klein will be doing the presentation, and we'll share more information with you once we're ready to present that. So look out for that, and that will be up on our podcast and on YouTube. Ernest, how you doing?
Doing as well as I could be.
Good, good, good. I took a quick vacation, so we didn't have a podcast last week, but thank you for checking out all of our other podcasts.
Chose a good week to go away, weather-wise.
I did. And
sitting in Toronto.
Yeah, it was the first big snowstorm in Toronto, though it didn't last very long.
It was, right? I think, I don't remember the number of years, but I think it was the earliest snowfall for, I think, maybe 40 years, or something like that.
I miss that. But don't worry, there's more bad weather in snore for these eastern countries. So, Ernest.
Northern countries.
Northeastern countries. Yes, we live in the north and it's cold in the winter. So, Ernest, we wanted to touch on a couple of our companies that reported earnings near the end of October and early November. TransDigm, Garmin, and Brookfield, major positions for us. Which one do you want to start off with first?
We can talk about TransDigm.
Okay, go ahead.
So TransDigm, the kind of the overhang on the stock to the extent that there was is that Boeing and Airbus were just not building planes, right? There was a production strike. They've had issues. Boeing has had issues getting planes back in the air and getting them certified by the regulators.
This has been an ongoing thing for Boeing for a number of years, right? Pretty much they had issues with their Dreamliners and other airplanes and regulations. So I think the demand is there. It's just that they haven't been able to satisfy the supply.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why you're seeing the average age of the existing fleet getting older and older as airlines are, you know, really using the planes to their last, you know, drop, quote unquote.
So I had a question from a client the other day saying, well, if they're going to be selling all these new airplanes, won't they be retiring older airplanes? And won't that eventually be bad for TransDigm's business because it doesn't make as much money selling, you know, directly to the initial building of the airplane? It makes the big money on selling the aftermarket parts.
Well, no. So I think the big money is made on the aftermarket, right? They are in the OEM business, so they do sell to new planes, but only to the extent that these parts get qualified into the aircraft so that there is the long tail of aftermarket parts that they're able to sell as the planes are flying and require ongoing maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
What usually happens when these planes get replaced by, let's say, Air Canada or Delta Airlines is that these planes don't just get They don't just go to the scrapyard.
Yeah.
They usually get sold to emerging market countries for airlines that just don't have the money to be able to purchase new planes.
That's exactly what I said to the client. I remember flying to Cuba on a Russian airplane that I think was made in 1955 with green shag carpet and the bathroom. I probably hadn't been cleaned since 1955.
Right. Yeah. And so there is no, like, I don't know if these guys end up using TransDigm parts or not, because the regulatory process for the types of parts that they have to use is probably a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the good news for TransDigm is that Air Canada and Delta Airlines on the new 737 MAXs or whatever plane they decide to use, TransDigm has actually more content for these planes so that they're actually better off as the planes get, the fleet gets replaced by newer planes.
Fascinating.
And so this is the aftermarket business. It's doing very well. It's up, I think it's like 7-8% this year, going to be up another 7-8% next year. And it's really a recurring revenue business, which is kind of the foundation of TransDigm's business model.
So TransDigm kind of fits into a company where the founder is no longer running it, but life goes on, right? So we've seen, you know, Constellation Software stock get pummeled as Mark Leonard, you know, unfortunately had to step down due to a health issue. We saw Berkshire Hathaway stock pull back when Warren Buffett retired. TransDigm, founded by Nick Howley, who you know, was a genius business model. You know, the stock is now much more, the company's much more mature. And it is now on to its, I think, third president's?
Yep, this is the third one. They have a new president again. And I think that's kind of the concern about the company is that, number one, now we're on the third generation from the kind of the original creator of the company vision, so to speak. And then you add to the fact that the company is just that much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to continue to make acquisitions that are needle moving for the company is TransDigm going to be able to grow at the same pace that it has been able to do in the past?
Yeah, I guess these are the similar worries that one would have with Berkshire or Constellation Software, right? The business model makes sense when these companies are much smaller, but now with Constellation close to $100 billion market cap, less now, and of course Berkshire at $1 trillion market cap, you know, buying a $1 billion business may not do very much.
No, and I think there's a couple of things I would say to this is that, number one, the core business of TransDigm, which is the aftermarket parts, and to some extent the defense business, which we didn't even talk about, those are still very healthy, growing, high margin businesses.
That's right.
So even if they don't make acquisitions, they're just harvesting the cash flow from these businesses and doing buybacks or special dividends.
Yeah.
I think you're going to end up with a pretty good result.
I think people have to get off the fact that you know, a company that compounded at a dramatic rate since it was founded, once it matures, the business doesn't end. It may not grow. Like TransDigm was one of the top performers on the I don't know if it's on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, going back for 2 decades.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean you can't have nice returns going forward.
Yep.
right? Especially if the underlying business, as you mentioned, continues to grow, and as there's still more fragmentation and potential to make more improvements, more acquisitions, so on and so forth. And so, you know, just because it compounded at 30% in the past, it may not mean that it grows 30% going forward, but it can still grow at a very nice rate and compound your returns.
And the other thing I think that is sometimes missed about great capital allocators and these types of compounders is their ability to go beyond the market that they're currently serving, right? So
Go ahead.
Yeah, TransDigm has talked about like going beyond aerospace. Mm-hmm. So they've taken some steps where they've acquired testing companies, they've dipped their toes into medical segments. And so really looking to for ways to continue to make acquisitions in other markets where they can create value.
That's right.
And Constellation Software, we've talked about many times, the vertical, they're in vertical market software because that was the attractive thing that they knew how to do. Mm-hmm. But Mark Leonard has been thinking for a long time about things adjacent or even totally unrelated to vertical market software. Right. So if we go maybe over the next 5 to 10 years and we look at what these companies are, they may have a very different business mix.
That's right. I think that's really good. And of course, for those that fear that, you know, the stock price will never recover for Constellation and Berkshire, now that the founders have stepped down, all you have to do is take a look at TransDigm and how well it has done since Nick Howley retired, right? It had you said, well, I'm not, I mean, Nick Howley's gone. He's the architect. He's the iconoclast. Never going to be replaced. I mean, and you sold the stock, that would have been very detrimental. So
you got to give these guys some credit.
You got to give them credit. I think it's not like the new CEOs are being replaced by people off the street,
right?
Right? Yeah. Or some AI robot. There are in some cases with Constellation or with Berkshire, there are people who are taking the top spots who've been at the company, you know, for decades.
Yeah, we've seen this at big techs.
Yeah.
Where I think for Apple, like everybody was wondering, is Tim Cook ever going to fill the shoes of Steve Jobs?
Yeah.
And I think it's certainly Steve Jobs was a one of a kind person, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, a visionary in terms of building what Apple was. But that doesn't mean that Tim Cook is not a very capable executive.
For sure. And I remember when Apple had a market cap of a few hundred billion dollars and people said there's no alpha, there's no upside in a company that big. And now, of course, what is it, almost a $4 trillion company? So let's focus on what really matters, which is the compounding of the current cash flows. TransDigm this year paid a large special dividend.
Yep.
That's on top of the large special dividend it paid in 2024, and aggressively buying back shares in the quarter, correct?
So they did what we call a dividend recap, mm-hmm, which is basically they issued debt, took advantage of kind of falling interest rates and weak spreads to pay out a dividend. Mm-hmm. And they do this from time to time, where they want to maintain a high leverage, which is pretty unusual for the types of companies that we look for. Mm-hmm. But they want to maintain a high leverage because it's ultimately going to increase the returns, mm-hmm, and they use that as a tool to increase returns to shareholders.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the year, of course, we had Elon Musk start this Doge.
Yeah.
There was a lot of discussions about what is all this defense spending that's happening in the U.S.? Are they being overcharged? TransDigm got caught up in that with some other military companies. The stock fell. It seems to have recovered very, very nicely. The other worry, of course, was the slowing growth in aftermarket. But TransDigm said it's just, you know, their business is lumpy, right? It's not like you can, the orders grow every single quarter.
Right. And then, I think with the defense business, I think it's proven to be harder than it might initially seem to actually reduce government spending on defense.
Yeah.
And you add to the fact that TransDigm's parts are usually quite essential to the operations, mm-hmm, of the military aircraft and these programs. So I think that business has been performing.
That's right. Well. And Musk has moved on from Doge, and
seems to be quite involved back at Tesla.
Yeah.
And as he should be.
Yeah. And his relationship with Trump should be more more about dancing at Mar-a-Lago to YMCA. So talking about I think TransLine reported strong earnings and it gave nice guidance for 2026, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so on to Garmin. Garmin stock was reached an all-time high a few weeks ago. We thought it produced a good quarter. This company, I think it slightly raised guidance or at least in-line guidance. The quarter was good. The company's seeing strong demand on most of its business lines. However, the stock has pulled back with kind of the rest of the market, as we've seen over the last few weeks, of course. November has not been pretty. Any newsworthy items that Garmin laid out in the quarter?
They did a little deal, which is kind of performance data tracking, which is very fits into their strategy where they can integrate this data into the watches that they have, right? Mm-hmm. I think one product that they launched this quarter, which it's not going to be super material, but I think really highlights their strategy and focus in terms of what they're doing is that they entered into the horse tracking market.
Horse tracking.
So it's called, I think it's called Blaze. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it's like these devices that you can attach to your horse and you can, it'll monitor your horse's health.
Okay.
And it's sold to people who are, you know, enthusiastic about those kinds of things.
Is this for horse racing or equestrian?
Yeah, both.
Okay.
And this fits perfectly into Garmin's strategy because the horse tracking market, to the extent that you can even call that a market, it's a tiny market, I'm sure. But the people who, you know, ride horses and care for horses, like, they really, really care about
their
horse.
Oh, yeah, it's a big investment, right?
Because my daughter once took horse riding classes, and it's a very dedicated group of enthusiasts for this market, where the distribution is special. So they have these stores that you can buy special horse riding gear from.
Yeah.
It's a market where people are willing to pay for high performance products, and it's a market where, quite frankly, there have been no alternatives in the past. So this is exactly what Garmin loves to do, is find these markets where they're niche markets, so not really almost worth the attention of something like Apple to focus on, but they can create a high quality product that people are going to use and they're going to love, and it's going to work very well.
Any lowlights in the quarter? Anything that caught your attention for negative?
Yeah, so I think there was a the outdoor segment, so the watches for hiking and outdoor activities, that segment had underperformed a little bit this quarter. Part of this was just because last year was so strong, right? And they were kind of comparing against that. But big picture, not really any meaningful structural problems at the company.
I think the company called out that it expects to have a very good Christmas season.
Yeah, and then I think lastly, in their marine and aviation segments, so, you know, equipment for boats and planes, that's been, I think, those have been markets that have been kind of under pressure for a while after COVID, and we're starting to see that improve.
Yeah. For those clients that don't follow a company, do you want to quickly just give a reiteration of the thesis for Garmin?
We did a whole podcast on this, so I think you can check that out.
Beautiful.
I think it was about a year ago.
Yeah.
But I think one of the rules that we have here is that, so Garmin has been one of the names that worked for us that hasn't, like, in kind of contrast to the rest of the portfolio this year, right? And one of the rules that we have here is that we don't arbitrarily sell a stock just because it went up when businesses is performing well.
Correct.
Right? And so I think that has played out for Garmin, where we bought the stock because we thought it was a good company trading at a cheap price. Stock kind of ran up immediately after we bought it.
Way faster than we expected.
And then we discussed. So it's like, well, it's up now, so should we sell the stock? And we thought, well, they're doing all these great things, so why would we sell?
Absolutely.
And we're happy to continue owning it.
Sounds good, Ernest. And of course, Brookfield Asset Management in the news. Today, of course, it's November 19th, whatever day it is, Wednesday, November 19th, talking about raising a new fund with NVIDIA and Kuwait?
Yeah, I think it's the Saudis and then backed by NVIDIA for a AI infrastructure fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to keep in mind that this is basically Brookfield raising third-party capital.
Yeah.
So from NVIDIA and from Saudi Arabia and so on.
Other investors.
Yeah. Where Brookfield will then go out and use that capital to build data centers and earn fees, management fees, and performance fees on these assets.
That's right. And so, it proves out the thesis of Brookfield, where they say, because we have the expertise, we have the size, the scale, the scope, the people, that fundraising for us is so much easier than if Barry and Ernest started a private equity fund and tried to build data centers.
I wonder what our client response would be if we tried to raise money for a data center fund here.
I think it would start the F and end with off. So,
I think that has always been Brookfield's strength, which is kind of, you know, people criticize Brookfield for this, where they said they're just kind of chasing the wind, right? Mm. They're going wherever the wind blows. But I think that's what you want to see as an asset manager, is that they can raise money and create new products based on what investors want at that moment.
There's no bigger market right now than the investment in AI, right?
Yep.
What do we see? Brookfield talk about $3 to $5 trillion invested in AI over the next 4 to 5 years. Of course it should try and get a piece of that.
Yep.
And it has expertise in providing power, providing communications, providing capital. And, I would trust Brookfield's over many other private equity companies to do the right thing. There has been some cracks in private equity recently.
Yep.
We've read about some of these private credit companies. What is private credit? That's just money that's lent to private companies for leverage buyouts, M&A.
Right. Unrated debt.
Unrated debt. Really risky stuff. And with we've seen some worries in the market and some cracks with some of those businesses. No question, some of the parts of the North American economy are doing great. Some are flailing a bit. What did Brookfield have to say about its exposure to private credit? Because it does offer private credit funds to its clients.
Right. So I think before we talk about private credit, I think Brookfield's credit business today is largely Oaktree, which they acquired from Howard Marks in, I think, 2019, was it? And then just recently took full ownership of it. So Oaktree is kind of known for their opportunistic and distressed credit strategy, where, they, because of Howard Marks and his whole value philosophy, they're not really a private credit lender in the way that you read about on the news, where they are funding leverage buyouts or those kinds of things.
They're more opportunistic. They're looking to invest when the poop hits the fan, so to speak.
Yeah. They do a lot of kind of asset-based lending, and they do a lot of distressed credit, but less so on the leverage buyout type.
Got
private
it.
Credit.
So the risk isn't really there.
So a little less exposed to that side. But I think the overall sentiment about private credit is certainly dragging on Brookfield this quarter, because we almost see headlines daily about funds that are having to halt redemptions, or where they're having issues kind of managing the credit worthiness of the portfolio.
And this is in an economy where the GDP is positive and interest rates are coming down.
Yeah.
God forbid we enter into an economy where things get worse and interest rates go up, or that could be really, really bad for private equity, especially the riskier parts of private equity. But we feel really confident about Brookfield because it doesn't play in the risky parts of private equity.
I think that's kind of what Brookfield has always been talking about, which is that Brookfield is not really doing like KKR style large takeovers of these gigantic companies.
Correct.
What they're doing is you know, most of it is real estate, infrastructure, data centers, mm-hmm. pipelines, utilities kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then even in the private equity side, it is not really doing the types of deals that other firms are doing. So, not to say that all of their investments have gone well, but certainly feel much better about where they are compared to other firms.
And before we get into our feature discussion on oil and gas, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Warren Buffett's Thanksgiving letter.
Yep.
Warren said that he will no longer be writing the annual shareholder letter.
Yep.
That's usually comes out in what, April or May?
Yep. Along with the annual report.
Yeah. So that Warren, but he still said he may write a Thanksgiving letter going forward.
Yes.
Yeah. Warren always says the same things. Never bet against America. I think Berkshire stock will be very rewarding to shareholders. It may not do as well as it used to do, but he feels very confident. He's not selling any of his shares, but he's certainly looking to do philanthropy and gifting shares to his children so that they can maintain the Berkshire legacy. Anything that you read in the letter that caught your eye?
Yeah, I thought he gave a really good pitch for Berkshire stock in the letter, actually, mm-hmm. where he talked about he thinks that what Berkshire is going forward is maybe slightly better than market growth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at their portfolio of businesses that they have, which are the railroads, the insurance, the utilities, the Dairy Queen, See's Candies, and all that stuff.
I like Dairy Queen.
Yeah. It'll grow very slightly faster than the economy. More importantly is that it's uncorrelated to the economy. And so in good or bad times, like it'll probably do pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
They have much lower downside volatility than the market mm-hmm. because of the cash balance that
300 plus billion, like a third of the market cap pretty much.
Yeah.
In cash in U.S. Treasury T-bills earning 4 and 5%. That's pretty defensive, yeah.
And lastly, probably the most shareholder-friendly board of directors and management team in most of corporate America. So you put those things together, so better than average growth, lower downside, better downside protection, and shareholder mm-hmm. friendliness. And I think that's a pretty good recipe for success going forward.
That's right. And of course, one of the big headlines was Berkshire, the company. We don't know if it's Warren Buffett or whomever made the decision, but a purchase of Google. Now, Berkshire owns Google, owns Amazon, owns Apple.
Yep.
So whether or not Warren is comfortable investing in technology, certainly the other portfolio managers at his company feel confident in the growth of tech and the ubiquity of those business models as great global platforms.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty spicy letter overall, yeah. where you can kind of feel that he was taking shots at unnamed people, but you can kind of guess who it was.
Yeah.
Where he talked about, for instance, he was talking about the compensation practices and the types of managers that Berkshire likes to look for, which are people that, are going to get rich if they do a good job, but are not looking to build dynastic wealth with massive compensation plans that, really go out and show, have big shows of their displays of their wealth, right?
Like Elon, for example?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And then when talking about Greg Abel, mm-hmm. he said one of the reasons that he likes Greg Abel is that he understands the P&C, property and casualty insurance market, far better than most P&C executives that exist in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So you can speculate as to who he was talking about, mm-hmm. but that's, I thought he said more in there than he usually does.
And he mentioned a few times, whether it's in the letter or in prior meetings or conversations, that Greg Abel is a better business operator than Warren is. Warren
yes.
is a great stock picker, a great thinker, but Greg Abel can get down and dirty and help improve the
right.
operations of the acquisitions and the companies that Berkshire owns. So we're so excited to see how Greg Abel performs going forward. Thank you for that, Ernest. Oil and gas. This has been an interesting year for the price of oil. You know, we had Middle East issues, we had the tariff worries, we had worries about potential recession. Then we've had strong results from AI and spending, so that's made the U.S. economy look a little better. But oil prices have kind of been stable in the low 60 to high $50 range.
Right.
Natural gas prices have picked up lately, and that may be part of the demand for natural gas used as a fuel for LNG to be sent to other countries that need natural gas, as well as the demand for AI. Hard to know. Maybe a colder winter.
Yep.
The big ramble, what I'm trying to say is, you know, these are well-run businesses, great companies. They haven't knocked it out of the park this year in terms of stock performance, but, you know, what these companies are doing and how they think long-term is the reason why we're sticking with them.
Right. So I think a lot of, especially people who are, you know, specialists in oil and gas, I think they usually like to talk about Canadian Natural and Tourmaline Oil, which is actually a gas company, as kind of the generic generalist plays for Canadian oil and gas, where you own them because, you know, you want to participate in the energy sector, but you want to own the bluest chip name and you don't want to get fired by clients if it blows up.
So if you're a closet indexer and you're trying to mimic the Toronto Stock Exchange, for example, and you want to have exposure to oil and gas, no question, you're going to gravitate to the Tourmalines and the Canadian Natural Resources and the Suncors of the world.
Yeah,
you know, big branded, well-run companies, been around for a long time, good balance sheets, tremendous years and years of reserves, great operators, but certainly a less exciting story than a small oil and gas company.
Exactly, and so I think I agree with most of that analysis.
Yeah.
Where,
why not?
Yeah. For like the reason that we own these companies is because they're big, they're very well run businesses. And I think an important point is that we never invested in these companies because we had a strong view on what oil and gas prices were going to be.
In fact, since we bought both, the price of oil and natural gas has gone down.
Right.
So clearly we didn't have a smart view of the commodity prices. But since we've owned those companies, their dividends and their production per share has gone up.
But what we focus on, and this is true not just for these two names, but for, you know, the portfolio in general, is that we focus on good business models and good assets.
Yeah.
Because that is, you know, what allows you to participate in the growth of the industry, but also protects you from the downside when things are not as rosy.
Well, clearly you have to have a view on the underlying commodity, right? You have to at least believe that we'll be using oil and gas for the next 10 to 15 years.
Right.
And you have to have a view that hopefully the demand for it will grow at a GDP-like rate, or and then hopefully there'll be some positive surprises that come out of nowhere, like the demand, the huge demand for energy as a result of cooling data centers.
Right. But, and when we looked at Canadian Natural, I think what we did was we said, okay, they have these great long-lived assets, which are the oil sands properties, that they can produce 50 years into the future. And at $40 WTI, which is, you know, what it has been in the not roughly 2020 era, you would earn this much cash flow per share. If oil prices were $100 a barrel WTI, you would earn this amount of cash flow per share. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in bad times, you would earn roughly 3 to 5% free cash flow. In good times, which whenever they come, you would earn 15 to 20% free cash flow. And in kind of normal $60 to $80 WTI, you would earn maybe 8 to 12% free cash flow yield. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how it has played out, where, you know, some years you're going to earn a little bit less and your return is mostly going to come from the dividend. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, in a good year, you're going to earn a little bit more because oil prices are high and the company's making a little bit more money. But on average, your return is still going to grow you're still going to earn a pretty good return over time.
As long as the companies grow production,
yes,
keep costs under control, have success drilling wells,
yep,
don't have major accidents or regulatory issues. And that's really been the case for both Tourmaline and Canadian Natural Resources. That's why we own them. Just amazing operators, and have proven it for years and years and years.
And I think what we care about is that these, as the largest scaled players, there are benefits to doing so, where it really protects the company in weak times.
Yeah.
Where for Canadian Natural, they have preferred kind of access to pipelines when space becomes available. Mm-hmm. So they're able to access markets better. Mm-hmm. They're able to kind of consolidate production and use kind of nearby sites to lower production costs, which is what they do when they make acquisitions. And so you have this kind of culture of continuous improvement where they're continuing to lower the cost of production. They're growing production in a very predictable and low cost way. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see how you're going to do too poorly owning a company like this.
So one could say that you're overpaying to buy the premium type companies in the industry, but I think that's what you should be doing,
right?
Especially when these companies have such durable reserves,
yep.
Right? And so the market loves to reward certainty, loves to pay a higher premium for companies that have the ability to grow for a very long period of time and grow their business, right? And so when a Canadian Natural Resources says it has decades and decades of reserves and they're able to get them out of the ground at low costs, and when Tourmaline says we've got tons of inventory of undeveloped wells that we can, you know, provide, and we can use our balance sheets to make more acquisitions, we feel really confident in it. Tourmaline, of course, has been an underperformer recently because of what we like companies to do. Not focus on the short term, but focus on growing production over the long term, growing the business meaningfully and doing the right thing over the long term. But it has hurt Tourmaline's near term results.
No, but for Tourmaline again, the business model matters.
Yeah.
I'd rather own Tourmaline, where they're the largest scale player. They have kind of very diverse marketing, so they're consistently able to achieve premiums for the gas that they're selling.
Yeah.
They own most of their processing infrastructure, so they have
when they sign these big contracts with LNG plants or supply, when you're signing they want to make sure that the counterparty is big, is large, and can deliver on its deals, right? You don't want to do it with a Barry and Ernest oil and gas company. It's too risky.
They own all their infrastructure, so which gives them a cost advantage versus smaller companies that have to use third-party infrastructure.
Yeah.
They have a capital advantage because, number one, they're the largest company, and they have the relationship with Topaz Energy, where they're able to use that.
This is Tourmaline.
Tourmaline.
Yeah.
And they have a great track record of making acquisitions of kind of adjacent properties to grow gas production into the future.
And I'm like a broken record on this, but CEO Mike Rose would agree with us because he keeps buying more shares of Tourmaline oil for his foundation and for his personal investments.
And so when you contrast Tourmaline to like maybe a smaller natural gas company that largely sells into the AECO stream, so they have no marketing diversification, they use third-party infrastructure, and they just are essentially a subscale provider, extractor of natural gas.
So bet on natural gas and maybe their success on drilling.
So in good times, that company's obviously going to outperform Tourmaline, but for the long run, I'd prefer to stick with the proven operator.
Mm-hmm. So Tourmaline put some jitters into shareholders by saying, for now, we're going to focus on growing our business.
Yep.
Less focus on buybacks and special dividends.
Yep.
And so that's kind of put a lid on the stock. Now the market wants to see how big the costs are going to be and if it's going to deliver on those promises.
Right. I think that it makes a lot of sense to me.
Obviously.
And you know, like I don't I think that if there are sector specialists who are able to consistently identify, you know, smaller companies that are able to outperform, then, you know, that's obviously they did a great job.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to continue owning these companies that have the track record of what they do.
So everybody talks about AI, data centers, LNG. What did Tourmaline's management have to say about, its bullishness for those?
So what's interesting is that there is a blog that I subscribe to that talks kind of about semiconductors, data centers, and all this stuff, right? And so he did a really thoughtful piece on a topic about how energy is going to ultimately, where's the energy coming from for data centers?
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of buzz about using nuclear because of its low carbon status.
I heard we're going to shoot, make data centers in space
yeah.
and have the sun provide the energy.
Well, yeah, so.
Could happen, but it's not happening tomorrow. Yeah.
And to that point, why would you do that when you can get negative priced natural gas in Canada? Right. But kind of
because we're not building any pipelines to provide the gas. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. Aside, though. Yeah. So the problem with nuclear is that these just have the lead times to build a nuclear reactor are just too long.
Yeah.
Right. It's what you care about when you're building the data center today is that you can get it up and running.
Yeah.
Right. And so for that, only natural gas has the ability to be able to do that. And so what you're seeing in Alberta and in other places is that data centers are actually popping up kind of close to gas processing plants where natural gas infrastructure companies will actually sign contracts with data centers. They will directly link the pipeline from the processing plant to the data center and kind of bypass the public infrastructure grid that exists.
Very exciting.
And so I think you'll probably see more of this. Mm-hmm. Obviously, anything in Canada that is contributing to incremental natural gas demand is going to be a positive for natural gas pricing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly just good news.
Yeah. So we've seen natural gas is at the highest price of the year so far.
Mike Gross called it, by the way.
Yeah, he might have called it. although, natural gas pricing is seasonal.
Yes.
When there's the shoulder season, when there's no air conditioning and no heating, natural gas doesn't really do very well. And the last couple of winters haven't been so cold, which is still the majority of demand for natural gas. Weather can shift, but there's no doubt that the demand for AI for natural gas has certainly been picking up some of the slack.
Yeah. So one other thing I want to maybe just lastly about oil and gas and commodities is that one of the reasons that we generally don't want commodity companies is that they usually operate in jurisdictions that we are less comfortable with, right?
And amen, brother.
And you can quibble about whether the Canadian government and how they've kind of treated the oil and gas sector in the last decade, but the reality, I'd still much rather own a commodity base that's largely in Canada.
Yeah.
Versus a third party, a third world country where it might be run by a military government and you really don't have a stable rule of law.
We've seen disasters like that happen all the time.
Yep.
Whether it's a copper mine, a gold mine,
yep.
Natural gas,
where the government just says,
It's ours.
Yeah, it's ours, right? And so that's another one of the, oftentimes people ask, why don't you own this? Why don't you own this? And part of the reason that we own these two companies is that they are in purely Canadian companies. Well, I guess CNQ has some south,
it does have, it's a large company. It does have some exposure outside.
Very little.
Yeah.
But these are largely Canadian companies that operate within Canada and under a very stable regulatory framework, which is something that I think is not discussed enough with regards to commodity companies. Mm-hmm.
CNQ has performed quite well this year, even with oil prices under pressure, unlike natural gas. Another year of dividend increases. The company was active earlier this year, right? Making an acquisition from Shell, making one other acquisition also. So it's less focused on returning capital to shareholders and more about getting its balance sheet back in order. And that may take a couple of years, but then off to the races again. One should expect significant share buybacks and maybe even special dividends if oil prices cooperate.
No, and I think they had a kind of an investor open house where they were talking about the potential to grow production. And one of the things about Canadian oil and gas that is kind of relevant going forward is that to the extent that, you know, now the political climate has certainly changed a little bit, but generally I think countries want to extract oil and gas from places that are carbon friendly, mm-hmm. so that are more favorable to the environment, which is why the Pathways Alliance project, which is the carbon capture project that oil sands companies in Canada have been working together mm-hmm. for, is so important for the industry. Mm-hmm. Because to the extent that they're able to lower their emissions, that is what's going to enable them to grow production into mm-hmm. the future. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think there was an announcement today in the Globe where the Carney government is working on an agreement with the province of Alberta where they're going to be, it's not announced yet, but they're going to be providing funding and support for Pathways.
Pathways for carbon capture.
Yep.
And and these are good signs. Of course, we'll see if Carney's budget passes.
Yep.
Right. But certainly some infrastructure spending is in that budget. Some are concerned, of course, that the Canada might be blowing its brains out, but some say it's about time we're doing some of these projects. And, you know, bottom line is that Tourmaline and Canadian Natural Resources should benefit from more infrastructure spending in Canada as a result.
Yep.
So that's all we got for you this week. What a great discussion we had. I hope you check out our podcast every single week. Don't be a stranger. You know where to find us, and we'll see you back here real soon.
This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.